From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. In 2025, two of my colleagues and I did some interesting interviews for the program, and today we present three of our favorites. Eliza Billingham talked with Hannah Vancara about her work to change military rules and allow amputees to become flight nurses. If you missed the conversation the first time, you'll hear an interesting twist in the story. Kathy McMorris Rogers served Eastern Washington in Congress for 20 years, but today she's a private citizen and creator of a new leadership institute, which she described for us. And Owen Henderson talks with Julie Tate Libby, who has written love letters to her hometown in Washington's Mattow Valley. Our Inland Journal Best of 2025 program is coming right up. Spokane nurse Hannah Vancara has been challenging a U.S. military policy that forbids amputees such as her from serving in some capacities. SBR's Eliza Billingham was interested in hearing more about Vancara's story, so she invited her into the studio.
I've been wanting to serve in the military as a flight nurse for 4 years now, and I started that process back in 2021, but it's been complicated to try to join because I'm missing a leg below the knee. It's from a congenital birth defect called fibular hemimelia. So I had a lot of surgeries as a kid. And even though I pass all the fitness tests required to join and am extremely active, the military had a disqualification for civilian amputees trying to join. So I fought back on that. And I went to my congresswoman after being denied accession into service. And we started a bill in Congress together to try to change those standards for amputees trying to join if they can pass all the fitness tests required.
Can you talk a little bit about the fitness tests and the waiver process for people who aren't familiar?
When you try to join, whether it's officer or enlisted, and in my case it would have been as an officer, as a nurse, you have to go through the MEPS process. And you have to complete this physical with one of the military doctors, and they review all your medical history. And it's not like the good old days where you can just show up with your packet of paper describing all your medical conditions. They look through everything. It's all electronic medical records now. So they will collect all of your surgeries, past medical history, and they'll review that, and they'll generate waivers based off of the things that aren't currently accepted in the military. What I found out with having an amputation, though, is that that was absolutely disqualifying. There wasn't even a waiver available to progress and actually commission as an officer. So back in 2021, when I was facing this barrier trying to join, I went to my congresswoman, I talked about the issue, and that's when we decided to move forward with a bill. It was called the Hannah Vancara Service Act, and it basically stated and proposed that anyone with an amputation should be allowed to serve as long as they pass all standard military fitness requirements without accommodation. And that bill went to National Congress. And I went over the past 3 years, I went to DC twice to lobby for this bill. It passed the House twice as part of the National Defense Authorization Act and went to the Senate. The Senate ultimately deferred it to the DOD. Or Department of War, excuse me, for their decision. Going to the House and Senate, I talked to both senators and reps and discussed, here's the challenges we're facing with military recruitment in general. Here's me in person trying to join. And yes, I am missing a leg, but I want them to know that what they see on paper is not reality. I'm very proud that I think I got very far with that, because in the 3 to 4 years of advocating for this bill, so many people, I would say hundreds of people, came out from under the rocks all over the country saying, hey, I have this issue too, XYZ. It may not have been an amputation, but they were denied for another reason. They never felt like they had the chance to serve. So what happened ultimately was this year, earlier this year, I'm happy to announce that Congress issued the first explicit recognition that amputees do get a fair pathway and a chance into military service. And Congress is now officially encouraging the Department of War to expand waiver consideration for amputees. And that wasn't an option before. It just needed addressing. Amputees now get a chance to serve, which wasn't possible under the old accession rules. I take joy in fighting for others, especially those who are misrepresented. As I mentioned earlier, I am a nurse and I care for others who can't care for themselves. And I love fighting for people who are able to do things and to make sure they know that they're not broken. People who just need a fair shot. And so seeing this change happen is proof that persistence matters. And now Congress and the Department of War know that this problem exists and they're trying to do something to change that.
Because you weren't trying to lower standards, right? You were just trying to draw attention to a group of people that meet the standards?
Correct, yeah. I want to be clear. I'm not asking the military to lower standards just for the sake of inclusivity. In fact, I believe the opposite. A strong military needs strong standards, and I'm proud of the improvements we've seen over the past year. But the problem was never the standards itself. It was an outdated rule in the military medical standards for service that excluded civilian amputees without considering what modern prosthetic technology can actually do. Today's prosthetics are remarkable. In many cases, people using them are stronger physically and even emotionally because they've lived their whole lives adapting and pushing through that adversity. So I don't think the military was factoring in that consideration before with modern prosthetic technology. They were allowing people to stay in who lost limbs while in service, but they didn't want to take on the liability of letting people join who were already amputees.
So what does this rule change mean for you?
I started this journey to try to get in myself, and it's morphed and changed into this journey that has supported so many other people. And I never expected the amount of support, the people that I was able to help, and I couldn't ask for a better outcome. It's young people and future soldiers coming up behind us, behind everyone here right now, who want to serve but face medical barriers. So now they have a path forward that didn't exist before. So to me, that's pretty life-changing. However, now that this change has been made and the opportunity exists, I am choosing not to pursue joining the military as a nurse right now. I'm getting married next year to an active duty service member. His name is Ben, and supporting Ben's journey as a pilot is now my priority for our family. This wasn't about me getting a slot in the military. It was about creating a pathway for every capable amputee and every capable person in general who dreams of serving. And those who want to serve should be able to do so. And that's enough for me. I'll continue serving as an ER nurse and eventually flight nursing in the civilian world. But I'm kind of dropping the mic on this for myself. And I'm hoping that someone else takes up the reins and continues moving forward.
That's Spokane nurse Hannah Vankara speaking earlier this fall with SPR's Eliza Billingham. This is Inland Journal, and we're revisiting three of our favorite interviews from 2025. I covered much of the congressional career of former Eastern Washington Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers, going all the way back to her taking office at the beginning of 2005. She's always been very cordial but guarded in our discussions. When I talked to her last June about the creation of her new leadership institute, she was much more relaxed. Here is our report as it originally aired. Former Eastern Washington Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers has been out of the spotlight since leaving Congress at the beginning of this year.
I made one trip to D.C. since December, and I've really been taking a break and not in a hurry to fill the schedule. Our girls are in sixth and eighth grades. They're finishing up, and then Cole is a junior. So, you know, there's lots of kids' activities, and that's where I want to be right now.
McMorris-Rogers says she hasn't made the decision yet about whether there's another office to run for or another job that would put her back in the public eye. But she has created a nonprofit, the Kathy McMorris-Rogers Leadership Institute, to promote values important to her.
The Leadership Institute is really driven out of a desire to pour into a next generation of leaders across the board, but especially high school, college students. I find myself reflecting on my time in Congress and, coming from Kettle Falls, farm kid, first in my family to graduate from college. I'm so grateful for all the mentors that I had and people who took time to mentor me, as well as leaders that I looked up to and opportunities that I had that really made a difference in my life. And I want to be, part of it is a desire to provide more opportunities for leadership development, both here in Spokane, and, we might do some partnerships across the country too.
So when did you start actually planning an institute like this?
Well, it was actually an idea that former Speaker Paul Ryan gave me, as I was leaving Congress. I had conversations with other members who had served and had moved on to the next chapter. And he had started an institute in conjunction with Notre Dame. But he just said it was a great way to stay involved and help, influence where you want. And that was kind of, he planted the seed. And then I've just started to develop it a little bit more. Certainly the focus on high schools. I've spent time during my years in Congress visiting high schools and talking with students about our Constitution, about our form of government, why America really is unique, that, at the founding of our nation nearly 250 years ago, it was a revolutionary idea at the time that we were created equal. That's laid out in our Declaration of Independence. And just what America has represented to the world, and we're not perfect, but you look over the last 250 years, America has done more to lift people out of poverty, raise the standard of living more than any other nation in the world. And I'm wanting to talk to them about my perspective and the opportunities that I had, but also just being a representative. And politics is in the news today, so they always are very engaging and like to, there's a lot of good questions that they have. And I just enjoy spending that time with them.
So what sort of role do you envision playing? Is it mostly a public speaking role? Is it behind the scenes? What do you see yourself doing?
That's a good question. We're still developing it, but one area is around Constitution Day. There was a law that was passed by Congress when I was first elected that every school is to teach the Constitution on Constitution Day in September. And so that's something that we think that the Institute can help with the teachers in the schools to facilitate and figure out, what different schools might be doing in conjunction with Constitution Day. But also, it's also identifying current leadership opportunities. There's a lot of groups, a lot of organizations that take young people and others to Washington, D.C. or other areas. I did the Civil Rights Pilgrimage a few years ago with Congressman John Lewis, who, that was really meaningful. And so I've given thought to perhaps some of those opportunities also, but making sure that helping get the word out on college campuses and high school campuses as to leadership programs that might be available or pilgrimages or tours that they might be able to plug into. And it's all a part of leadership development.
So how do you pay for an enterprise like this? Do you have folks who are giving you money, writing checks, or are you bankrolling it yourself? How do you do something like that?
Well, there's some seed money that's been made available, and there will be, I'm hoping that others will come alongside and join in this effort. Some of that will still have to be developed.
You have stepped away from Congress, but do you envision reaching out to some of your former colleagues to take part in events maybe that your institute will be putting on?
Yes. For example, this former colleague I was just talking to, he said, "Well, Kathy, if you ever have a group in D.C. and want a tour of the Capitol, I love to take leaders, future leaders, on tours of the Capitol." And I think there really is an opportunity to engage with leaders, both in Congress and in the administration, Republicans and Democrats about America, this greatest experiment in self-governance that the world has ever known, and leadership, especially political leadership, but you know, just leadership across the board. There's other business leaders that have already reached out also and have said, Kathy, you know, if there's ever anything I can do, I would welcome an opportunity to, you know, to speak with future leaders also. So I think, you know, there's a lot of, so I'm really encouraged by the response so far. There's been a lot of positive feedback and people that are interested in being a part of it.
So when you sit down with students these days, now that you've sort of stepped out of it, you still know most of the players there. Do you answer differently about than you may have a year ago when you were right in the middle of it about how do we make sense of what's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I think certainly it's more freeing when you're not having to think about how everything's going to be probably received or, you know, potentially interpreted, perhaps. You know, there's just, it's always a challenge. Yeah, I can just speak from my heart, from my experience, and I don't have to defend or explain anything else that might be going on in D.C. at the moment.
So as you watch what's going on today, how do you feel about the future of this country right now?
Well, I have a lot of faith and confidence in America and the American people. And that's part of what drives me is that, you know, I had the honor of representing the people of Eastern Washington for 20 years. And I was inspired every day by the people, and I got to tour and meet people, and even if we didn't believe, you know, the same ideology, I was inspired by people that were making a difference in a whole host of ways, you know, just different passions and talents and giving back to their communities and building stronger families and communities. And you know, when I look at DC today, I mean, it's easy to focus on the division or the fighting that might be going on, you know, the political battle. But I would encourage people to keep an eye on the American people and what you're doing in your own family and your own community. That makes the biggest difference. That's the foundation of our nation. And I do hope that Americans can take a step back and just reflect on, you know, what this great experiment in self-governance has brought, not just to us as a people, but to the world, and that, you know, believe that our best days are yet to come and figure out how we can work together. Yes, we need to build trust. That was something that I really focused on. And when I became chair of energy and commerce in my last term, I really felt like the relationships and the trust that I had built among my colleagues on both sides of the aisle. I mean, we passed legislation out of that committee unanimously on, you know, the TikTok bill and apps that are controlled by other adversarial countries, right? We passed a price transparency bill in healthcare unanimously at a time when people would say, that's not possible, right? And I look back on it and I believe it was because of a foundation that had been built. And that's the foundation of America. And so, you know, more than anything, I want to inspire people to believe in America, believe in this nation. As I said, we're not perfect, but we have, and none of us are perfect, but we continue that search for a more perfect union. It's so beautiful and inspiring when you think about, you know, just that continued search for a more perfect union and that we all get to be a part of it.
Kathy McMorris Rodgers served Eastern Washington for 20 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, and now she's the founder of the Kathy McMorris Rodgers Leadership Institute. Author and anthropologist Julie Tate Libby has put pen to paper to talk about an area very dear to her, Washington's Mettow Valley. Last summer, she spoke with SPR's Owen Henderson about her book.
In the introduction, you write that the book is a love letter to a mountain town that you used to know or that you once knew. You also advise newcomers to the area to, I believe the phrase you used was tread softly.
Yeah.
And both of those struck me as I was starting your book. What prompted you to describe your own book that way and to give that particular piece of advice?
Well, it was interesting. So the book, I had a friend read it about 3 years ago. And I said, what'd you think? And she said, it was your love letter. And I was like, oh, I like that. You know, so I incorporated that into the title. And it really is a love letter. I love the Mettow. It's my home and it's my community. And I love it very much. And so I think some of the changes that I see occurring, you know, are, I wouldn't say they're necessarily sad to me, but they're different. And I feel like the ethos is changing a little bit. And so I feel like I wanted to bring something that reflected on those changes and that is a bit of nostalgic, you know, it's a little bit lamenting the changes. But I mean it in the best way possible. And, you know, there are people moving in. And I think as a newcomer to, say, Hawaii or other places that I have also lived, I want to be mindful to myself to, you know, be aware and to be and to tread softly when you enter a community. Rural communities, you know, are special places. And to be aware of the people already there and kind of what you're encountering is to be a good neighbor.
So you got your PhD studying a concept called amenity migration, and it plays quite a role in this particular book. First, let's just kind of level set. Why don't you define amenity migration for us?
Okay. Well, amenity migration is different than other kinds of migration. Most migrations, people move for work or for family. They call them the push and pull factors. You know, famine and drought and civil war could be push factors. People get pushed out. Pull factors would be jobs and family and things like that. But an amenity migration is different because people move for lifestyle. They move for like intangible assets. Places that tend to be populated by amenity migrants are beautiful. They're usually by national parks. They have a lot of outdoor recreation potential and things like that. So I think that the pull of those places is kind of what you're looking at. And then they kind of become this message for this place or something. They kind of have this brand, like this outdoor recreation area or something like that. So amenity migration as a concept, I think, is just that it pulls people for different reasons that have never been really pulled that way before.
How has amenity migration played out in the Methow?
Well, I think, you know, there was a ski hill years ago back in the 70s. They were trying to put a downhill ski resort into Mazama. And that was a huge deal when we first moved to the Methow. It was still kind of going back and forth and people did want it and people didn't want it. And it was a big kind of development controversy. And I think, you know, that was finally put to rest in 2002, I believe. And in lieu of that, I think it's become sort of a center for amenity migration. So there is no big development. And tourism is sort of a secondary industry, but the real industry is actually building and second homes.
With amenity migration, something you touch on in the book is the way that changes how people choose who they associate with, their identity markers, their reference groups,
sure.
I believe is the term.
Yeah.
Explain that a little bit for me of what is a reference group and
sure.
how has something like amenity migration in the Methow changed how people are associating themselves?
Right. Well, in traditional, you know, as an anthropologist, in traditional family systems, people associate themselves based on their kinship. You know, what's your last name? Oh, you're from that family. And I think even up until, you know, the 80s and even the mid-90s, even in the Methow, people were still like, they had the homesteader families or your last name or what creek do you live up? Oh, you're Twist River or you're McFarland Creek or whatever. And so those were kind of the social identifiers before. And now I think with amenity migration, people identify based on a reference group is a group of people with similar interests and tastes and hobbies, basically. So, you know, people group themselves around what they like to do for fun, for recreation. And that's really different than the traditional sort of land-based systems. And I talk about in the book, like living in Hawaii, where it still is a very kinship-based economy and a kinship-based system. And in Hawaii, you know, people all know each other by their last name, and they're related to hundreds of people all over the island. And they're very proud of that. You know, being from the island and being related to somebody is, that is a marker of belonging, and that's empowerment in Hawaii. And that's changed in the Methow.
I was curious about your perspective as someone who has lived in Hawaii as an outsider and who's lived in the Methow, both as a local and as an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about the differences you've seen in terms of how amenity and migration has affected local culture.
I think in Hawaii, in the area that we live, there's also amenity migrants, but they're mostly retirees. And they're not super wealthy. You know, they have pensions, but it's a retiree community. And it doesn't change, it doesn't shape the economy as much as I've seen elsewhere. I think in Hawaii, I talk about in the book, people come there, but they don't really change the culture. The culture is still really rooted in family and, you know, hunting for pig and fishing. The rural culture is still really embedded in this kinship system. Yeah, I think in the Met how incoming migrants have really changed what it's known for. You know, the areas that are more popular, Mazama has more ski trails. You know, people want to live on the ski trail. Winthrop is kind of the old west town and stuff. And then, you know, anything to Wisp and south has become more low income. And so, you know, you can see it geographically, kind of this separation of people based on interest and class.
One thing you discuss quite a bit in the book is the nonprofit sector that has grown up in the Metau Valley. And so tell me a little bit more about the socioeconomic class split as you have observed it.
Well, I think in the Metau, there's like 118 nonprofits or something, and there's only 7,000 full-time people or 10,000 altogether, full-time and part-time. And so that's a really high number of nonprofits. Only 37 pay an executive director, so it's not that big. But I think that amenity migration has really influenced, you know, the nonprofits. They have their board of directors, and a lot of them are composed of people who have just moved in, who want to be part of the Metau, and, you know, there's a lot of good, positive energy around that. And I think there's also some misconceptions. And so I think the nonprofits are supported by donors, and so that kind of leads this whole other, it's like a whole secondary economy, you know, where it's the business community. They're trying to make a living. I had two businesses in Winthrop, one when I was 22 and the other one when I was in my 30s. And, you know, it's hard to make a living in Winthrop. It's hard to run a business. Tourism is a very seasonal industry in the Metau. You know, summers are busy. Winters, if the snow's not good, winters are slow. You know, it can be almost a ghost town in Winthrop. And so it is a hard place to make a living, no matter what you're doing. And so I think fundamentally the class difference is people who are economically tied to the Metau Valley. You know, if you're tied to it and you make your money from the Metau, you know, you're going to see it in a completely different way. And I found that living in Hawaii as well. I had never worked in Hawaii until about 3 years ago. And then I got a job teaching at a public high school full time. And that was a deep dive into knowing Hawaii in a way that I had never known before. So I feel like being kind of an outsider in Hawaii and kind of getting into it and working there and everything has given me a lot of perspective as well. And then reflecting on that to the Metau has been interesting. And that's some of the things I wanted to write about in the book, was the differences between being an outsider one place and an insider in another place.
You are a resident in the Metau Valley. You mentioned 7,000 to 10,000 people, depending on how you count it. I'm from a small farm town. I know that word travels quite fast in places like that. And you are very frank with your opinions and your observations. It is a critical eye, but not an uncaring eye toward your home region. How have people in the Metau been reacting to the book?
Well, I think it was a little bit of a rough landing. There was an article that came out in the newspaper that was not flattering for the book. And I was quite devastated when it came out. I almost thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to fly back to Hawaii and just scrap the whole thing. But I persevered, and we launched the book a couple weeks ago, and it was a great reception. People were very gracious, and I think they're interested in the book, and I think they're curious. And everybody I've talked to who has actually read the book or started to read the book has been very positive. I think that people really do love the book. I think the press in the paper was unfortunate. But, you know, I think it's hard for people to talk about class. It's kind of a taboo subject. And I've never really understood that, because to me, as an anthropologist, it's always been very interesting.
That's Metau Valley author and anthropologist Julie Tate Libby talking with SPR's Owen Henderson. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at SPR News. It's on the radio Thursdays at 12:30, Saturdays at 2:30, online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. You can visit there every weekday morning and find our new daily podcast, SPR News Now, hosted by Owen. I hope you have a happy new year. We'll talk next week. I'm Doug Nadvornik.